Hi, Ruth Ann. It's so good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks.
Now, before we went to music, I did a little bit of an introduction of you and talked about your background and about your book, but I want to personalize that a little more. I think your book is just so wonderfully written, and the photographs are just astounding. For listeners, what Ruth Ann has written is a book, Face to Face, Children of the AIDS Crisis in Africa, and with Karen Andes, is that right?
Yes, Andy.
Andy.
That, yes.
That there are these photographs where it just captures the innocence of the children and the hopefulness. There's just something really breathtaking about those photographs.
Thank you so much.
And your writing, Ruth Ann, really, it ties it together, and it takes something that I think can be felt as overwhelming and makes it still very poignant, but personalizes it by taking the stories of different people and following them and generally showing how much love and care there is and how resilient the communities have been in rising to deal with this crisis.
Well, that was really the point of the book. I mean, we felt that there were many people in this country for whom the AIDS epidemic just seemed so remote, and yet there were these millions of people affected. And the way to bring it really closer to home is to tell those very personal stories, and then people can relate to those children. They can see the images. They can read these stories. And I think it makes it much more accessible to people in this country who may not have otherwise any access to information or really have, any sort of personal, contact with the issue.
Mm-hmm. And in our first conversation, it was really a delight to find out that we had a friend in common. My friend Caitlin Brune has worked for the Firelight Foundation, and you had mentioned that she and Karen traveled together to Kenya.
Yes, they did. Actually, one of the organizations that Karen hooked up with very early on after her early trips to Africa was the Firelight Foundation. And she went with Caitlin at one point to document some of the programs of Firelight. Actually, they spent most of their time on that trip in Rwanda. But we have spent a lot of time visiting Firelight projects. There were two in particular that we visited in Kenya, Karen and I, and one of them was Mama Darlene's, which we talk about in the book. This became a project that we became very attached to. It was started by a woman, a very dynamic woman named Monica Ngumi, who had worked in the slums of Nairobi and then come back to her husband's ancestral home, which was a very small village called Tala. And the town was just overcome with orphans, and she mobilized to the community to start a school. And she embraced not only orphans but handicapped children, which was a wonderful thing because these children are typically shunned from the school system and from society at large. And she just built this wonderful program. She added a nutrition program, HIV/AIDS outreach, a theater group that entertained and also provided important HIV messages and so on. And this is a program that Firelight had supported when we first visited it in 2004. They were in a very, very small classroom, and it wasn't sufficient to accommodate the program, and Firelight provided funding so that they could move to a much bigger facility and expand and grow. They also helped them build a playground. So it was a very wonderful partnership between Firelight and this local organization that was doing good works for the children in the community.
And for listeners who may not know, Firelight is right here in Santa Cruz. They're a wonderful foundation that gives small grants, and their focus is on communities being able to support themselves.
Yes. That's what Firelight does. They go out and they identify existing programs that are already working in the community, and they partner with them, and then they help them grow and expand and provide support for them. So they have a lot of influence in communities really in a variety of areas in Southern Africa.
And now I know from Caitlin that part of their focus, what they prefer to support, are extended families to be able to strengthen them to care for orphans. Can you explain a little of the thinking behind that?
Yes. There have been a lot of studies that show that children who have lost parents really do better in an extended family situation, whether it's with a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, or even a foster care situation within a family kind of centered environment, as opposed to institutional care. I mean, there are a lot of concerns about institutional care, that children may lack focused attention, they may be more at risk for abuse, they may not get education. There are a lot of they may lose a tie to their culture and their community because they're living in this institutionalized environment. And it's also quite expensive, actually, to care for children in institutions as opposed to a family-centered environment. So that is really the ideal, to support families so that they are able to take in these children and help nurture them and grow. Now, we have visited programs in Kenya, orphanages, that have done, I think, an excellent job of meeting children's needs. In fact, one of the programs that we talk about in the book is the Saidiya Children's Center, which is a sort of a model project in my view, in that it's really a home of last resort, because these communities are sometimes so taxed that they don't have the ability to care for children. We had met this one young girl, Esther, who was 13 years old and caring for her mom and her three younger brothers. And then when the mom passed on, the children had no place to go, and the nuns in the local church spent months looking for a family who might take them in, but they simply couldn't find anybody. So they ended up going to this Saidiya orphanage, where they got very focused attention. The orphanage is a small project. It's run by women, a social worker, a woman who has a degree in child psychology, so they were getting very good nurturing and attention. They were going to school. The kids all go to school. This was actually the first time Esther had actually gone to school, was when she went to live in the orphanage. So I think it can be done. I mean, there are projects that can accomplish, you know, meet children's needs. But the ideal, of course, is that philosophy of focused, family-centered care.
And that was something that I loved, was the way that you showed so many different ways that can be nurturing and successful in so many different types of situations. And in terms of the extended family, it was a real kick to see the go-go grannies.
Oh, yes, yeah. We had so much fun visiting with some of these grannies. You know, they have played such an important role, and they're kind of the glue that hold these communities together, because as the middle generation dies off, it's often the grannies who step in. And I think at least half of the children who are living in extended family situations are living with grannies. And we had one particularly wonderful experience when we were in Tala, this rural village, and we went to visit this 98-year-old granny who had taken in her great-grandson because there was nobody left to look after him. And we just showed up one day, it was the middle of the day, and she was sitting on a stool outside her mud hut, and she was just so excited to see us. I don't know if she had ever seen a white person before. And she got up and she started to dance, and she was from the Kamba tribe, and they have these whistles that they use as instruments, and she started blowing her whistle, and soon there was a crowd that gathered around us, and the women were ululating, and it was just one of those wonderful experiences, and you can just see, you know, the joy and the exuberance in this woman. And we saw that with other grannies that we met, very resourceful people. We met this one woman who lived in Kitui, which is sort of east, a couple hours east of Nairobi, and her daughter had died and had left behind an infant. And this woman was quite poor, and she explained that she could not afford to buy a cow to supply milk for the child. So she breastfed the baby. This woman was, you know, well on in years, and yet she was able to coax milk out of her breast in order to feed this child. Again, you know, that incredible resourcefulness that we saw with so many people that we met. We met another granny who was living in western Kenya. This was a woman, her name was Paulina. She was actually 91 at the time, and every one of her 12 children had passed on. In fact, the very last one of her children was dying when we came to visit. There's a photograph of her in the book with one of Paulina's grandchildren, and Paulina took on the responsibility of caring for 16 grandchildren, which was just remarkable. And you hear a lot of stories like this of grannies throughout southern Africa who've taken on, you know, multiple grandchildren. And they do it out of necessity, but they also do it with a great sense of spirit and joy.
In that section, I can't tell which photos I like best, the ones of the children or the ones of the grandmothers. They both just glow.
Yeah, they have a remarkable spirit.
How did you come to write the book in the first place?
It was really Karen, actually, who jump-started this project. She had originally gone to Africa with her husband in 2002, like most people, to go on safari and see the animals. And she met this woman by the name of Jill Simpson, who took her to one day to visit the very beginnings of an orphanage. Jill was a longtime children's advocate, and she had met these two young boys who were about 6 and 8 at the time, David and Cyrus. And they had been wandering aimlessly about town for about a week looking for their mom, who had disappeared. And ultimately, the mother was found in the morgue in a pile of bodies. She was, you know, yet another victim of AIDS. Oh. And so Jill had taken these children in and started this project. And the day that Karen visited, they ran out of rice. So Karen and her husband gave them some money, and they took some photographs. And then Karen came home, and as she was developing these pictures, she was using then film, black and white film, and these images started to emerge, and she realized that she had a choice. Either she could just send back some photos and leave it there, or she could turn her life upside down and really make a commitment to help these kids, and that's precisely what she did. And then she got me involved. We have been friends for many years, and she came to me repeatedly. She has traveled to Kenya now 9 times. And each time she would come back from her trip and say, you really must come with me. And it was a natural thing for me to do because I'm a medical writer and have been for decades, and I had been covering HIV/AIDS, the epidemic in this country. So it just was sort of a natural extension of my work here.
Natural tie-in for sure.
Yes. But I have to say, going to Africa, I had worked very closely with AIDS patients and caregivers in this country. I was on the staff at UCSF, based at San Francisco General Hospital, which is sort of the epicenter of the epidemic here.
Yeah.
But there was nothing really that could prepare me for the emotional impact of seeing conditions under which children were living in Africa. It was really, it was just, it was so devastating. And the project just really grew out of that. There was just, once you have that kind of an experience, there's just really no kind of turning your back on those folks.
And I bet their resiliency and their spirit and still their love and their children, they still want to play, and just seeing the conditions and their health, the deterioration, and what little they had.
It's true, you know, they had very little, and yet people were so, they seemed so upbeat, they were welcoming, they opened their arms to us, they really seemed to take a lot of joy, even in just sort of basic everyday sorts of activities and things, despite the fact that they had absolutely
nothing.
I mean, they lived with so little. It was really quite stunning.
I know, and then knowing what we have here in the States, just the discrepancy. I spent a little bit of time in Guatemala, and I mm-hmm. experienced that with the children there, but they weren't under a plague like AIDS either, and they weren't dying.
Yeah. I mean, you have this combination of both, you know, the poverty and disease. It's really quite a lethal combination.
Well, what were some of the more memorable experiences that you had? There are probably so many. But
it's hard to say. Certainly, we spent a lot of time in the slum of Nairobi, and that had quite an impact because I had never seen poverty of this magnitude before. We spent a lot of time there visiting with teens who were caring for younger siblings. These were children who were orphans and had, again, they were the primary caregivers in the family, like Esther.
Forced
and we spent several
over.
Days going around visiting them there in their homes. And they were all getting some support from a local NGO at the time that was helping them with rent and food and school fees, and gave them some, they all had some income-producing businesses. They would be selling vegetables on the street. Oh. But it was really so eye-opening for me to go and see these homes. They were living in these really tiny little one-room shacks and in an environment that was just really beyond
My
anything
word.
That I could have imagined. I remember the first time we went there, we visited a project. This was actually another Firelight project called KikoShep, the Kibera Self-Help Program. It's a very, very well-established program, quite large now, and they have a whole range of everything from support groups. They have their own school. They have income-producing businesses. It's a very far-reaching program, and they do all kinds of good work in the community. But the woman who took us around on that first visit said she had once hosted a woman from Malawi, which is one of the poorest countries in Africa, and this woman came to Kibera, and she started to cry.
Oh.
She had never seen poverty so acute, you know, in this concentrated area, you know, of a million people. So that was quite an experience for me to see that. And then you see that alongside, you know, Nairobi is a city of great extremes because you have Kibera, this slum, that's set alongside some magnificent, you know, mansions and gardens and so on. So you really see the contrast right in that city alone. And so that had quite an impact on me. I remember, I have a lot of memories of those.
I know,
those,
it seems so discompassionate and heartless. That we, in many nations, that is the in Brazil as well, you'll see skyscrapers next to slums.
Yes. It's really quite magnified there. And, of course, when you come back to this country, I mean, I would come back from these trips, and I would drive down these pristine roadways to Stanford Medical Center with all of its, you know, state-of-the-art equipment and compare that to the, you know, I also visited hospitals in Kenya that didn't even have the equipment to treat children with, you know, diarrhea and the sorts of basic kinds of, you know, technology and so on. So it was really, the gap was just staggering.
And yet their spirit, these teenagers living in shacks, taking care of their younger brothers and sisters, their will to survive.
Yes, they seemed very, very strong. They had very good support, fortunately. These groups were very effective in providing them not only with just, you know, sort of basic, you know, life essentials, but also they had support groups where the girls could go and they could talk about the issues that they were facing on a day-to-day basis so that they had, you know, some emotional and psychological support as well.
And these were the NGOs. They had set up support groups for them of grief and PTSD.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Yes.
Ruth Ann, speaking of Malawi, I wanted to thank you for participating in my little economic experiment.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about like what we did, because it's something that I'm hoping to create a different type of model for how mm-hmm. we engage in commerce.
Yes.
So what we did is that Ruth Ann sent me the book, and rather than paying her for it, I made a donation to Partners in Health, which is headed up by Paul Farmer, who has he taken an official position with the World Health Organization? Do you know, Ruth Ann?
My understanding is now that he is serving as an ambassador to Haiti, I believe.
Ah.
You know, he had his start in Haiti. And so I believe he's serving under Hillary Clinton as an ambassador to Haiti.
Right. I thought I had heard something like that. Yeah. And for listeners, Paul Farmer is the founder of Partners in Health, and the book by Tracy Kidder, Mountains Beyond Mountains, the Pulitzer Prize winning book, was written about him. Really a phenomenal person.
Hmm. Yeah, he's really something. I actually have met him, and I interviewed him at Stanford on a couple of occasions. He's an incredibly impressive fellow. He developed this whole model system of care initially in Haiti, but he's taken it abroad to a number of other countries. In fact, they're intensively involved now in Rwanda, but it's a system of care where in the places where you don't have technology or where you lack caregivers, because there's a severe shortage of physicians and nurses in many of these countries, he has trained community health workers, and these are just neighbors and friends within the community who go around and they check on patients on a regular basis and make sure that they are taking their medications, because it's very important if you're HIV positive and you're on medication that you consistently take the medication. And so he has developed this whole network of these community caregivers. What's that?
Doesn't he call them accompanitors?
Yes, exactly.
It really is the most brilliant system. Because it takes it, and it takes whatever little bits of money that you have as an NGO, and it really distributes it throughout the community so that you are supporting not only the person who's sick, but also you're supporting the network at a very inexpensive level.
Yes. I remember him. I went once during a speech several years ago talking about even the technology, you know, the way that you measure whether a person is doing well on AIDS medication is through a test called a CD4 test. This measures a number of immune system T cells in the immune system these are the cells that are targeted by AIDS, and this is the standard test here in the West. You don't always have the access to those tests. And he would say, we don't need CD4 tests. We can just go and look at assess a person's functionality. Are they able to get out of bed in the morning? Can they shop? Can they cook for themselves? Can they take care of their children? You know, this is a very low-tech way of just sort of assessing whether this person is doing well on meds or whether they're not doing well. I believe they're now doing CD4 testing in those facilities, but in those days it just simply wasn't available. So he would just take a very simple sort of low-tech approach to things.
And I love him too, because he's sneaky. He does workarounds. I remember reading that he calls food nutritional supplements, because you can't get food covered under the whatever the U.S. aid money is, but if you call it a nutritional supplement, then they'll cover it.
He's a very clever guy.
He is, and he's just, he's really relentless. I think he's one of the most, now he says that he's not uncompromising, that he does triage. I mean, he does compromise all the time, but he sets the standards for what the level of care would be at a higher level than anyone else I could really compare to.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's building a system now of care of clinics in Rwanda that is considered actually a model for Africa as a whole.
Hmm.
Yes.
I know that his test of equality was, is this what I would want for my loved one?
Mm-hmm.
And you really can't set the bar any higher than that.
Yes, yes, you're right.
Now, one of the things that he talks about are the complications between AIDS and TB and also malaria. And I think you write a little bit about that.
Well, yes, it's true that TB is the most common infection that in sub-Saharan Africa that you see in AIDS patients. And in fact, it's the most frequent cause of death is tuberculosis. And I mean, the reason being is that this is a bacteria that's relatively easily transmitted if you're living in very close conditions. A person who has active TB is typically coughing, and so they're spewing these particles into the environment. And so if you're living in a close family situation, as many people do in Africa, you know, maybe they're in a one-room hut, the disease spreads fairly easily. And if you have a compromised immune system, you know, as AIDS patients do, then you're much more vulnerable to that kind of infection. So TB is unfortunately very common, and we actually, a lot of the patients, the people that we met, were being treated for active tuberculosis. Mm. And malaria is another sort of complicating issue. It's a little bit more subtle than the TB relationship, but what the research suggests is that people who have who are HIV positive are at greater risk of getting malaria, and that the malaria, once they are infected with the parasite, that the malaria parasite can actually speed up the progression of their HIV disease.
Huh.
And in pregnant women, it's particularly dangerous. An HIV positive pregnant woman is likely to have more episodes of acute malaria, more fevers, more anemias, and their birth outcomes are also poor. So there are a lot of complicating effects from, especially in a region, sub-Saharan Africa, malaria is a highly prevalent disease. So it these co-infections, you know, with these malaria and or TB further complicates the picture.
Another thing I remember reading in Mountains Beyond Mountains was that the only place that Paul Farmer could sleep well was Cuba, because in Cuba, everyone had a doctor. And so when he would come to the U.S., he would be still caring for people. And I think Chicago, he's done a lot of work around there. But in Cuba, because they, you know, I think their primary export right now is doctors, I think that their sense is that they just will train anyone who has that interest and who is willing to work hard enough to get the education.
Mm.
So the question that I always come back to is, why do we set the bar so high for someone who's interested to become a doctor in this country? Why don't we train everyone to the level, at the level to which they're able to, to learn?
Well, I think it's really an issue of capacity. We have a limited number of medical schools in this country and a limited number of slots. It's very expensive, actually, to train a medical student. At Stanford, for instance, where I work, the tuition, which seems very high, doesn't even begin to cover the actual costs of training that individual. So it's a very expensive proposition, and so there just are a limited number of slots available throughout the country, I mean, even in the United States, to train physicians. It's a very labor-intensive process.
Hmm. But Cuba seems to be able to do it without that expense, because they aren't looking at it in the same way of, it's not... it may not be a profession that ends up paying very well, but there are many people who are willing to go into it because they really want to help. And I guess where I'm going with this in terms of AIDS is that medical research also seems to me like something that that there should just be much more of, and that there should be a way for people to go into it without having to incur the debts that that, you know, that force them really into a position where they have to make a lot of money in order to pay back their debts.
Well, I wish I knew more about the Cuban system. I don't, unfortunately. I mean, I'm more familiar with the system in this country. And as, you know, as I said, it's really, it's just a very, very, if you're going to go through a rigorous training program, it's just a very expensive process. I mean, you not only have the 4 years of medical school, but then you have the additional residency training where students actually get practical experience in the clinic before they actually go out and practice on their own. So that's the way, that's historically the way the system has been developed in the United States, at least. Mm-hmm.
Now, when I had to leave the studio, this is Janae again, for a few minutes, and I missed some of the discussion, but what could we learn from Africa in terms of maybe more barefoot doctoring or medicine? Are some of the trainings more intensive and less expensive? They would have to be. I've just often thought that the training could be less expensive. One doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor. Someone could be trained just to dispense certain medications for colds and flus and minor ailments.
Well, you do have a lot of caregivers who, for instance, you have nurse practitioners, you have people who function as physician assistants. These are people who have not gone through, maybe not have completed medical school, but who have caregiving functions in the community. I saw, you know, a lot of those kinds of people because there's unfortunately a shortage, a dire shortage of trained physicians in Africa, and there's also the phenomenon of the brain drain. Those who are trained then leave the country. They come to the United States where they have greater opportunities and so on. So there is a serious shortage of practitioners in many of the countries of Southern Africa, and people tend to rely on those, as, for instance, the nurse practitioners or the equivalent of the physician's assistant, who provide perfectly adequate care in the community.
And what does their training involve? Where are they trained, in the larger cities or?
Yeah, I mean, there are university training programs. There are in Nairobi and Uganda. There are training programs for a variety, I mean, physicians as well as nurses and other practitioners.
Do you feel that they're filling the void? I mean, just the epidemic, though.
No.
Yeah.
Nowhere. No, there's a really serious shortage. This is a very, very big issue in the AIDS world, is finding a sufficient number of caregivers to provide services.
And what about medicines? Are they available to the people? I know that AIDS medicine here is very expensive, or it has been.
Well, this has been an ongoing issue. When I first went to Africa in 2004, I did not meet a single person who had access to antiretroviral drugs. The drug cocktails that were first introduced in the United States in 1997, and that changed the whole landscape of AIDS care in this country. AIDS at that point went from being a death sentence, exactly, to a manageable chronic disease, something like a diabetes or a heart disease. But it was many years before those drugs would make their way to Africa, and as I said, when I first got there in 2004, I literally did not meet a soul who had access to those medications, and I had people, community leaders, telling me that there were people who were poisoning themselves or committing suicide because they simply couldn't face the fact that they were going to be having to live with this deadly infection. So, but things gradually have changed over time, and actually, on our last visit there in 2007, I met quite a few people who were on medication by this time, and there are a number of programs that have grown up that are providing antiretroviral drugs. In fact, one of them is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the so-called PEPFAR program, which was established under the Bush administration in 2003. And I know Bush is not one of my great, I'm not a great fan of his, and yet on the AIDS front, I have to say he's been quite a champion. And if he has any positive legacy, it's that he made this major commitment of $5 billion over, $15 billion over 5 years for AIDS treatment and prevention and so on. And Kenya was one of the countries that was targeted under the program, and I did meet many people who were getting AIDS drugs through the PEPFAR program. And then there are other programs. There's the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, which has been supplying drugs. So gradually there has been a scaling up of treatment. The last figures I saw, there were about 4 million people on treatment now.
Great.
But there were still at least 5 million more who still need it. So, you know, we still have a ways to go. And the problem is for every person who's, in, you know, who's infected, there are, you know, three more who need treatment. So, it, you know, it's hard to stay ahead of the curve.
Sure. Just overwhelming.
Yeah. And the numbers are just so enormous.
And what is there a website, or how can people contribute and do something to be of assistance, either donating or actually going over there, or in what ways can they participate?
Well, there are many organizations that are active in this area. I mean, Firelight is certainly one example of a, you know, a small nonprofit that's doing good works. I mean, people could certainly get involved and contribute to that organization. There's another small NGO based in Half Moon Bay called GRACE USA, and they do similar kinds of things of identifying programs on the ground that are doing good works in the community. They go in, they support them. We actually spent some time visiting some of the programs that GRACE operates. One of them actually was a very interesting program in which they were supporting Maasai midwives. Mm-hmm. These are the women who deliver babies in the Maasai community. And they were, and Grace was helping educate them about just sort of basic things, the fact that you use gloves when you deliver a child to prevent, again, transmission of the virus. You know, you don't reuse razor blades when you're cutting the umbilical cord. Again, prevent viral transmission, and so they
universal
were providing
precautions.
Yeah, exactly. So they were giving them those sort of, you know, basic instruction, and we spent just a wonderful afternoon with these a very colorful group of midwives who were talking about their experiences and some of the challenges that they faced. I mean, they didn't even have access sometimes to water to bathe, for fresh water to bathe the newborns, because they live in an environment where they'd have to walk many miles to get to a well, and they didn't always have that opportunity when they were, you know, were called in to attend to a birth. So anyway, Grace is supporting projects like that, Grace USA, and so those are a couple of the organizations that we have worked with that I think are doing terrific work. I mean, of course, you have the larger groups like Partners in Health, Project CARE USA. There are many organizations who are active in Africa. The American Jewish World Service is another one. I went to one of their programs just last evening, and they were talking about their work in the Congo, and they're also very active in fighting AIDS. So those are some of the organizations that that I personally, I'm very fond of. Doctors Without Borders is yet another one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they do wonderful work.
They reach out everywhere.
We saw their clinics, and we ran into several clinics of theirs during the course of our travels.
I was just listening to CARE on Making Contact today, and they were talking about Afghanistan and how the militarization of U.S. aid, and how the contact of, or the use of the NGOs for sort of propaganda purposes is putting them in danger, and is making it difficult for them to be able to work in the area, because then they're seen as being complicit. And I know that that's been a concern with AFRICOM also, that many of the aid organizations look at the militarization of aid in Africa as being something that's been increasing lately. Did you notice that?
We worked primarily in Kenya, where there has not been that kind of, it's not a country in civil conflict in the way that, you know, you see in, say, you know, in Congo or Sudan or, mm-hmm. so those issues don't come up. We did not experience that. I could see how that would be a problem in some of these other countries where these are intense civil conflicts and the NGOs get sort of caught in the middle of that. We didn't see that in Kenya because of the nature of the political situation there.
I think, though, what he was talking about more was the resource wars and the U.S. trying to create this the humanitarian face on creating more bases, more military bases in Africa, that right now there's kind of China and the U.S. vying for control of a lot of the oil resources. That's really the last frontier. But I do think Kenya has been a little more protected from that.
They have. I mean, you know, Kenya doesn't have the vast resources that some of the other sub-Saharan African countries have. It doesn't have mines. It doesn't have oil resources. Mm-hmm. Its primary resources are coffee and tea and tourism. So you don't have the same sort of economic interest there that you have in some of the other countries where, you know, like the Congo, where you have, you know, or the copper mines and and so on. So it's a different geopolitical situation.
Kenya has even been protected against, their laws are that you can't grow GMO crops there. And so they've been protected more from the Green Revolution also.
Well, they do have issues, though, of sustainability there. And in fact, you know, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize several years ago was a woman who had started the green movement in Kenya because
Wangari
what has
Maathai?
Happened. Yes, Wangari Maathai.
Yeah.
Yes, because what has happened is that the forests are being denuded by either cattle overgrazing or by people cutting down trees to burn it down to create fuel for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do see these large areas that have been denuded as a result of, you know, overuse. And so there's this green movement that's growing to try to rebuild these affected areas. So that is an issue actually in Kenya.
And how are they dealing with that? Where can people start taking care of their needs like cooking and shelter without destroying what little land they do have that they are able to live off of? Do you know?
Well, that's the problem, of
course,
is that people's livelihoods depend upon, you know, their ability to graze their livestock or to provide cooking fuel. So the question is, how do you find other ways for them to develop, you know, income-producing businesses without destroying the environment? That's really the challenge.
It is, particularly in third-world countries right now.
Yes.
Although I think a lot more of that is the corporate. Annie Leonard, who did The Story of Stuff, I just saw today she has a new one out called The Story of Cap and Trade.
Oh.
And so she does, in these great cartoons, she shows how this cap and trade creates an incentive for corporations to go and just clear cut and then replace them with palm oil plantations and have them, you know, have that look like biodiesel so that they can get credits for that. But the entire thing actually produces far more carbon than it saves.
Mm. So they're taking advantage. Very much so.
Yeah, the system is really very flawed.
What can be done so that the land can be sustainable for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all
that's
these things.
What little
really
they have.
Very...
It's so unfair. They're taking the brunt of the planet deforestation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using actually so very little. And it's where they live. They're born there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see what happens over this next generation. And I wanted to read just a few of the statistics that you sent, Ruth Ann.
Yeah,
I think they'd be very interesting to people. It says that there were an estimated 33.2 million people living with HIV in 2007. Sub-Saharan Africa is home to two-thirds of these individuals, or 22.5 million people.
Right.
Globally, 2.1 million people died of AIDS in 2007, up from 1.7 million in 2001. HIV is the leading cause of death worldwide and the number one cause of death in Africa. Then there were an estimated 2.3 million children living with HIV in 2007 in sub-Saharan Africa. Globally, some 420,000 children developed new HIV infections in 2007, and 330,000 died of the disease that year alone.
And yes, actually, UNAIDS just issued just last week, as a matter of fact, some even more updated statistics, but they're very comparable to the ones you've given, yes. Mm-hmm. Still staggering numbers. There's not much that has changed, unfortunately.
Yeah. And but you say that 15 million children worldwide have lost one or both parents to HIV, to AIDS.
Yes.
That's incredible. And it seems like really a lost generation.
It is, yes.
Staggering.
And 12 million of those children live in sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow.
So, yes, you have, as you say, there's that whole middle generation that's being lost. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who power the economy, you know, the teachers and the
yes.
and the healthcare workers and just, you know, the folks who really you know, productive workers in society who are being lost to the disease. And of course they are parents, and so as they pass on, their children mm-hmm. suffer because they no longer have that role model in their lives.
So it's practically a whole continent that's being lost. It sounds like there are little pockets of improvement.
Yes, well, I mean, and that's,
here and
you know...
there. Maybe it's the tide
yes,
is turning.
I mean, that's why we are trying to show, you know, through the book that there is some hope, that there are these... and in fact, the more I go around and speak to various groups, the more people I meet
mm-hmm.
And the more organizations I become aware of who are involved in this issue. There's just a great deal of work being done on the ground to try mm-hmm. to reverse these trends, to try to support these children and their families, and to try to help people, you know, meet the challenges of AIDS.
And you wrote about the children, and so few have. That was your focus. Thank you.
Yes, well, the children just sort of tugged at our heartstrings, and it seemed like they were kind of the unwitting victims,
mm-hmm.
and we could see that it was really having an impact on them, and we wanted very much to help them to the extent that we could.
So, do some of the proceeds from the sale of your books go back into the communities, or?
Yes, yes. All of the profits from our sales will go to support these organizations that are helping children.
Great. So where can your book be purchased where that's guaranteed?
Well, certainly through our website, facetofaceafrica.com.
All right.
And there's also a lot more information about the book on the website. There are a number of local bookstores that are carrying it here on the peninsula. It can be purchased at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. In San Francisco, it's being carried at Bird and Beckett Books on Chenery Street. So those are some of the locations. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the Santa Cruz area.
We noticed that Kepler's did a very nice review of the book also.
Well, we did a presentation there a couple of weeks ago, and it was it worked out very nicely. So, mm-hmm. and it's an independent bookstore, and we like to support the work that they're doing. So, and
well,
they've been very kind to us.
Maybe we can get you down here, or Bookshop Santa Cruz, or
we'd love
Gateways
to do that.
Books.
Sure.
Well,
absolutely.
So maybe we could end with the Amy Goodman question, which is always, what gives you hope?
That's...
Well, what gives me hope are the people that I met who I found very inspirational. The people like Monica Ngumi, who took it upon herself to motivate her community to build a school to care for these kids. Or the people like Jill Simpson, you know, the longtime children's advocate who saw a need and rushed in and has built not only the shelter for children, but whole range of programs in her community. Those are the people that give me hope.
Yeah. And your peers and your colleagues and your co-author and...
Absolutely.
That, or they're working with you that we may never hear about, but they're there doing the work.
And the children themselves.
Oh.
You know, there's a great light about them, and I have hope for their future.
Yeah.
And I really recommend to anyone to pick up your book because it's something that will make you stronger. Seeing all of the people who are gathering to be able to care for these children, and just seeing the beauty of the children and that kind of circle around them of love and concern. I think it's something that will let people walk away feeling. With that, there's more light in the world.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for the work that you've been doing and continue to do, and hopefully we will have you here.
That would be great.
It would.
And I appreciate your support.
Sure. Thank you for coming on and sharing your story with us and the creation
thank
of your
you.
Book.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for us as well.
Thanks, Ruth Ann.